My name is Colm Tobin, and my new book is called On James Baldwin.
Colm Tobin discovered James Baldwin by accident as an 18-year-old. He had just been gifted a book token and, not quite at university, had the luxury of choosing a book that he wanted to read rather than one that had been assigned at school. He chose Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain. We're used to Colm Tobin's works of fiction, but his newest book is a collection of essays titled On James Baldwin, through which Tobin reflects on his own relationship with Baldwin's work and how it affected him as a writer and as a person. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Goulet, and here's my conversation with Colm Tobin. So we are recording this on August 2nd, 2024, exactly 100 years after James Baldwin's birth. What first drew you to Baldwin's work?
That simple business of seeing a book in a bookstore, looking at it for a minute, and being 18 years old. And there was a thing in Ireland then called a book token, which meant you got an amount of money from an uncle or aunt. And instead of being able to buy sweets or buy anything you want, cigarettes, you could only buy books with it. It's called a book token. And I had a book token for my birthday, for my 18th birthday. And I bought Go Tell It on the Mountain. And I don't know why. That funny business of just looking at something and thinking, I want to read that. It was not on the curriculum. I didn't know the name of any other books by James Baldwin. I would have known that he was African-American. I would have, as 18, been very interested in the civil rights movement in America, as I think everybody was in Ireland. And this book, I thought, Go Tell It on the Mountain, the religious thing, somehow interested me. That lovely business of picking up a book for no reason and taking it home.
So the book begins with your first essay, The Pitch of Passion, in which you describe how you first encountered James Baldwin's book that you just mentioned, Go Tell It on the Mountain, and what you did and didn't see in the book the first time you read it. You know, as you continue to return to Baldwin's work, what are some of the general noticeable differences for you as a reader since your first encounter at age 18?
I think with Go Tell It on the Mountain, there are two things. The first is that he plays with style, that it isn't merely he's working with a sort of a religious based incantatory style taken from the Bible or taken from religious ritual. There are times when he brings the style down to a very plain sentences that describe something. And so you're just watching all the time as the style soars, the tone goes up, and then you're watching something that's very close to piano music. And I suppose that's the first thing. The second thing is that the book, while seems to be about Harlem, seems to be about a young man's facing his destiny as a religious figure in the state of his soul, in Harlem, the background is actually a very interesting American moment because it's the story of the Great Migration, that this extraordinary movement of people from the southern states of America, especially African-American people, ride up into the cities from the countryside to the city, Chicago, obviously Pittsburgh, New York, Harlem. But everything that happens before the novel begins matters enormously to the novel. And those things all happened in the South. They're very close to slavery, but if not slavery, at least to an extraordinary amount of repression. The repression is being worked out in Harlem, but it isn't being felt in Harlem in the same way. It's being felt as history. It's being felt as legacy. So that's a fascinating. I suppose there is a third thing that really Baldwin doesn't bother having many white people speak. I mean, and indeed, why should he? Because there are so many white novels in which no African Americans get to speak, or there are so many Irish novels in which no English people get to speak, and vice versa. So it's not as though this is something but doing it was a moment, because instead of working out in a novel the struggle between blacks and whites in America that was really going to destroy his hero, his black hero in Harlem, he let the religious feeling, family feeling, things that happened in the past, all things that related to the self, to the family, to the soul, matter enormously in the novel, much more than indeed race relations.
You know, in several of these essays, you describe Baldwin's approach to storytelling or teaching through angles. For example, you write that the narration in Go Tell It on the Mountain might be called third-person intimate, where John Grimes is at a remove from the action that happens to him in the novel. Why might these angles or indirectness be so key to the way Baldwin writes?
Third-person intimate is an interesting one. It's where you use he or she, and you have mainly one point of view. So you say he got up in the morning, he went out, he saw two dogs, he went to the shop. And slowly, as you build it up, it's closer to the reader than I, than the voice using I, because you begin to see the world, feel the world, remember the world, and experience the world through the eyes, not the voice, but through the eyes of this individual person. Now, that's what happens in Go Tell It on the Mountain. So it's both distancing in that it isn't John Grimes speaking, it isn't John Grimes telling us his story, it's the story being told through his eyes at one remove. Now, this is different, obviously, from Giovanni's Room, where it's really a confession novel. It's where it's in the first person confession tone. Look what I did. Look how wrong I was. Look how mistaken I was. Look how differently I would do things now. But this is the story I'm telling of what I did. So it's the narrator's voice is the issue compared to Go Tell on the Mountain, which is the third person.
You describe the process of writing a novel in such an interesting way. You know, in the paragraph I just mentioned, you wrote that John Grimes is allowed to live in the novel at one remove from the action, or that the events of the South haunt the novel. And later you write how Baldwin had to battle for the right of his protagonist to choose or influence their destinies. And I was struck by these really active verbs, allow, haunt, battle, that you used to describe Baldwin's relationship to his characters.
I think writing is active. In other words, that you're not merely writing the words down, that you're constantly trying to work out strategies where the reader will get as much as the reader needs, but not more, perhaps something less. So the tone you use, the perspectives you use, how you let certain things happen. So, for example, what's happening, I think, in Go Tell It on the Mountain is the struggle within conscience for John's soul. So you're watching forces doing battle. And some of the forces are the forces, I suppose, of sensuous forces. I mean, forces to do with the flesh, carnal forces to do with sexuality. But others are deeply religious ones to do with something that he wants from the world that cannot be easily named or defined. And thus, Baldwin, I think, is sidestepping the large question of how would a young man like that, so sensitive, so intelligent, so deep, fare after his teen years in a place like Harlem? In those years, say the 1950s in the United States, he sidesteps that by stopping the book at a certain point, which is a sort of strategy.
You have quite a memorable moment of describing how, in creating characters, authors make someone whom only the novelist might fully and vividly recognize, an emerging self that lives within the self, passing for real, passing for fictional, wavering and hovering in the dream space between the two. You mentioned Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde or Wilde's Dorian Gray. Do you have some of your own literary characters who hover in this dream space?
You see, I think the very fact of fictionalizing itself, in other words, Baldwin making John Grimes, or indeed in another country, Baldwin making Rufus, or in Sonny's Blues, Baldwin making sort of the sensible brother and the jazz player, Baldwin is working with aspects of himself. But it's not as though this is a single, easy, simple process. It's one in which you're constantly using bits and pieces of things you know, bits and pieces of things you are, bits and pieces of things you invent. Now, anyone who works on a novel knows this process. And it's so hidden from the reader sometimes because obviously, I mean, unless you're writing direct autobiography, in which case it's never that direct. But if you're writing a novel in which the character has a different name than you do, then no matter what you do, you're dividing yourself. You're even making three versions of yourself. You could make yourself a woman. You could make yourself in the case of for example, Giovanni's Room, you could make yourself a white man in Paris. Baldwin is an African American in Paris, so that you're getting the very thing that's meant most to define you, which is the color of your skin. You're just saying that doesn't matter in the novel I'm trying to imagine, what something else matters. And so, yeah, that whole idea of that Stevenson, J Henry James loved it, of the just even playing it out, that idea of division of character. I think that Baldwin's story, Sonny's Blues, does that pretty well. You have the sensible brother watching the other brother. And in a way, they're both the same figure, they're divided.
Place and consequently displacement seem central to your project here, both in terms of how it influences Baldwin's work, but also in the ways you describe Irish identity. You argue, for a writer, there is nothing more potent than a lost place. Talk to me about this potency of displacement, particularly for a novelist.
You see, I think we really have good examples of it. We have James Joyce's Ulysses, which really it's set in 1904 when Joyce himself would have been 22. So the characters in it are not young men. They're actually from the older generation. It's James Joyce imagining his father and his father's friends in a Dublin that Joyce has lost, because in that very year, 1904, he left Dublin and he went to live in various parts of Europe, including Trieste, Zurich, and Paris. So what he's doing in the novel is reconstructing with love and invention the city that he once knew. And I think it's something that Henry James does with a novel like Washington Square. And I certainly think it's something that Baldwin did with the Harlem of his youth and in the Paris he went to. And indeed, when another, like another country, the Greenwich Village in which he wandered, that all of those places are, I suppose, in his great exile, are sort of lost to him. He doesn't really set a novel in Saint-Paul-de-Vence, where he lived later, but it's in these places where he has been, where he was born, where he has lived, which have mattered to him, that he set his novels not, and it's partly, especially I think the Harlem of Goethe on the Mountain is a lost place that the novelist is attempting to see again, build again, imagine again, experience again, and make real for the reader, set it down as though you were drawing it or as though you were indeed filming it.
It's no surprise in a book about James Baldwin that you discuss the political potential that writing can have. But I was intrigued by what I thought was, the unexpected twist on this idea when you discuss Baldwin's relationship to the civil rights movement. Rather than focusing outward on public policies and governmental reform, you trace how Baldwin explores the personal, the private, and what you call the examination of the individual soul. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, he really became interesting. When others were making speeches about the need for desegregation, about the need for various forms of legislation, which, Lyndon Johnson would finally put in place, Baldwin started to talk as a preacher to say, no. It's not about, you see, we don't have a problem as African Americans. You white people have the problem. So you have to solve your problem. You don't have to solve our problem. There's no African American problem. There's no black problem in America. There's a white problem. And the white problem has to do not merely with the fact that you're failing to pass equality legislation. That actually isn't the question. Of course, you have to do that. But the question is, what state is your soul in that you have done these things to people all around you? And that not only did you do them in the past, but you want to continue them in various ways in the present. Who are you and why are you so sinful? And he didn't actually use sinful, but he came very close. And this, of course, was a whole new way of approaching what was really meant to be, in one way, part of the civil rights movement was a reform movement, just to say, could these pieces of legislation be changed? But Baldwin was saying, no, it's a much larger question. The dream you have, the I have a dream, is not merely equality, but a change in, I suppose, the spiritual relationship between people and themselves, rather than between people and God or between one race and another. Look into your own soul. Why have you been? Why have you had these prejudices? What is it in you that has had these prejudices? This was tremendously powerful. He made these points on television, which is a place where you don't often hear people talking about the spirit or the soul or the stain on people's soul. And he made them in essays, which, in my view, are the enduring essays from that period. I think the next time we get it, essays of that sort of importance, we get Joan Didion's essays. I'm not saying that these essays collected in Fire Next Time and No Name in the Street, collected generally then in Price of the Ticket, Baldwin's nonfiction book. I think that we these essays, by any standards, are the enduring essays written in the second half of the 1950s and the first half of the 1960s by anyone at all in English.
You mentioned James Baldwin on television, and I want to talk a bit about this for a minute because it captured my attention as I was reading it. Because before 2020, most of my interviews were conducted by phone. And then now we primarily use Zoom because I can use visual cues and I don't like to interrupt. But you wrote about Baldwin's skills as a television performer. He might have been too thoughtful for television because he was easy to interrupt. But he also knew how to slow down to, so the camera would linger on his face as he prepared to say something difficult. How would he make out in today's media?
How do I know all this about Baldwin? I know it all because of YouTube. Because you just keep working on YouTube and you find there are about 20 times we can watch Baldwin. And like where in these years in America, a writer was taken seriously enough. And this included other writers. I mean, he wasn't alone in this. Norman Mailer was someone who was often on primetime television ruminating, telling the world what they thought about things. And now, yeah, obviously now I can't think of really a single show where someone like Baldwin could appear regularly. And he was often on his own, being interviewed by somebody, and he was let talk. Now, it's amazing to watch because what he's doing is he's working with light. You certainly watch him, but the eloquence is there, the points he wants to make, but he's using his face. And he's using his face just in certain moments to look immensely thoughtful, to immensely wounded, but at certain times, immensely sort of grand. And above all this nonsense about legislation or just trying to talk wisdom, and the wisdom is effectively religious. It's about saying, if you have been through this form of hatred, if you've been doing prejudice, there's something wrong with you and there's something wrong with your spirit. And he would say this on primetime television in a way which was, first of all, you couldn't argue with it. He wasn't, often he was put in a position where he wasn't arguing. Once he was arguing, he could be scathing, he could be brilliant. But really, it's amazing to watch him from sometime in the 50s to, for the next decade, as he hones his skills. Sometimes he puts on a slightly British accent. It's wonderful to watch him being haughty and being so right about everything. I can't think of anyone else who was doing that. And I took enormous pleasure in it. And I put all the stuff together and kept looking at it just to see this child. You see, he was a teenage boy as a preacher, and it gave him a sense of what could be done. But it wasn't just that. He had a natural sense, a natural theatrical sense, which I think also makes its way into the novels rather effectively. But he wasn't ever, he wasn't someone who was running for election. He wasn't someone who was courting popularity, and he wasn't someone who was leading a vast movement. He is the novelist, he is the writer, he is the poet and the playwright, not at the margins, but sort of above the fray at certain moments, able to articulate things better than anybody else.
One of our producers is a professor of 18th century literature, and she was particularly struck by your description of Baldwin's rhetoric in 1963 turning toward Swiftian contempt. Could you say more about this comparison to Swift and what makes Swiftian contempt an effective approach to Baldwin's political and philosophical arguments?
Jonathan Swift got into a rage. Again, he was someone who was used to preaching from the pulpit, got into a rage about English policy in Ireland, even though he wasn't Irish, but he became sort of Irish and he began to rail against them. And of course, he always moved in from an angle. He never said, pass this legislation and we'll all be fine. He began to, in a way, even parts of Gulliver's Travels are really about England and Ireland, but other things, there's a directions to servants, there's a modest proposal, for example. Swift, just says, well, since it is very expensive now to get food and the price of food is going up and Irish people are of no value, why don't we eat their babies? And he goes into immense detail over how these babies might be cooked, and he cannot stop himself. And you can just see the levels of rage in him emerging in these beautifully, these beautifully measured 18th century sentences. It looks as though, if you just looked at the tone, that he's saying something requiring a great number of semicolons. But in fact, it's the most outrageous attack on the idea of people having different values. I mean, people being worth different amounts, or people being able to say, well, so and so, really is a different race. That race is less than my race. And therefore, I can, it just brings it one step. But Baldwin doesn't do, I suppose he doesn't do direct satire so much as a sort of tone that really does, like Swift, find a way to move above the fray to go further than anybody else might. But Baldwin's direction, well, the spiritual direction was a direction of conscience rather than a pure political direction.
You write that Baldwin's essays and articles, written for deadlines and created to reflect their own moment, have a strange, urgent life to them when read more than a half century later. How so?
Robert Silvers, who was the editor of the New York Review of Books, told me that he couldn't find Baldwin. I suppose it was an article for Harper's or one of those magazines, and they put it on the cover, and the cover had been printed, which happens a lot in those years. You printed the cover, and then everything else came in later, and they couldn't find Baldwin. So he went around to where he thought Baldwin might be living, banged on the door for long enough that a Baldwin came out and looked at him and said, "What?" And he said, "Yes, I need, like, I can't." So Baldwin said, "Okay, no fuss." So he said, it was late. You go asleep on that bed, and when you wake up, the essay will be done. And I can't, I should have asked him what essay it was, but he said it was one of the essays that are considered one of Baldwin's great essays, was written in about 6 hours. There was nothing done when Silvers went to sleep, say at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was done and finished and perfect by 7 in the morning, when then it was printed a week later. But you know, I think that he had a mixture of things. He had a vision. He saw America, the great stained soul of America. He said he thought the people who came on the Mayflower were not dukes. Yeah, they were losers. They were chancellors. There were people down their luck who needed to go somewhere, so they came to America. So don't be too happy and proud of yourself if you're white. Like you came because you were really, you hadn't had any prospects there. And but that's, you know, I suppose then he begins to work with a style. And the style seems to come naturally, but he himself says that it came from a number of sources, including, of course, wide reading, but also, of course, the pulpit, the Bible, and the whole tone of the whole sound of, I suppose, religious writing. And the mixture of the worldly and the spiritual, the mixture of grandeur in his tone and a plainness, and the sense of mission was to move the argument above the mere matter of, you know, job opportunity or indeed equality of opportunity into a much larger thing to do with love. And he could talk about love in an essay. Lionel Trilling, the critic, you know, who was teaching at Columbia, said, "I wish James Bond would stop talking about love, because of course that's the word that most disturbs, isn't it? When you say it is about love, and you go, okay, but he would couch." He would use the word love in a context which he himself had established, which was beyond reproach. You know, because it wasn't really sentimental, it wasn't banal, and it wasn't easy to say. So the essays are beautifully constructed, and they matter, and they mean something. And some of them are written fast because there was an urgency actually in the moment to get that essay out next week. Here we are, these, what, 60, 70 years later, you know, this with this, it's now a Library of America book, the one I have. It's 1,000 pages, and I promise you it's worth spending a good 2 weeks just reading it and reading it, because these are the great statements made in the America of that time, in the same ways, you know, 80, 90 years earlier, we had William James, or we had Thoreau, or we had Emerson. Here it comes again, the great American voice.
You know, Baldwin's books are being re-released to mark this milestone of his birth. And you mentioned this 1,000-page collection. If someone has never approached Baldwin's work but would like to, is that where they begin, or where should they start?
I think I would begin with a story called Sonny's Blues, which is really about a jazz player. And it's about an idea of a doomed brother, the sensible brother, the doomed brother, and again, an African American moment, you know, one becomes the jazz player. I think that story is short. It just gives you a sense of what of just how beautiful Baldwin could write about music. He could make music matter enormously in the life of a character. After that, I suppose there are a few essays, the early essays, I mean, even the early essays about Harlem, but Notes of a Native Son, and yeah, I think the early essays, Go Tell It on the Mountain, Sonny's Blues, I think they would be also maybe the first 80 pages of Another Country, his later novel, which I think is an extraordinary achievement.
Is there a novel or essay that you return to again and again?
You know, in writing the book, which began with a series of lectures, I've been writing about Baldwin now for about a quarter of a century, but in giving the lectures, suddenly I began to look at something that I thought was important to propose him. And I suppose this comes from something personal. If I were an African American, if I were a young man or woman who was African American and American now, I would probably read Baldwin as a prophet about certain matters to do with race. And someone who saw through things. And but because I'm not, because I'm an just Irish guy who writes novels, I'm interested in style, and I'm interested in what has mattered in the end. Obviously, a great number of other things matter too, such as his politics, but that he really was a master of style. And so I just thought maybe in my book, I emphasize that more than I think I would if I were A, American, or B, if I were African.
Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked?
Yeah, yes, there is. there's a piece, there's a thing in the book that I wanted to try. And you can do this in a lecture, and then you could do it towards the end of a book, where I'm interested in the whole idea of what's politically correct. Now, I'm accepting political correctness as a form of good manners. that really there are a whole lot of words you just don't use about people because it's hurtful, and just don't do that. And I'm gay, so I know how hurtful queer was at a certain time, and I know that'd be better if people hadn't used that. But there are times when you wonder if the business of cancelling, of saying that someone has crossed a line, that person now must no longer be read by anyone. And I think this is a matter that we could look to Baldwin. A certain moment when William Styron published a book called The Confessions of Nat Turner, William Styron being, I suppose, a sort of a posh white writer, decided to write a slave narrative, which is fiction. Nowadays, I think we would argue, I would argue in any case, that it's very hard for a white person to start imagining what it would be like, that level of repression, that level of hatred, that level of danger. But in any case, it was written. And a great number of African American writers said, hold on a moment, you can't do this. And Baldwin supported Starr. It was very brave of him. And he said, he's written the story, the joint story. It's our story. Our story being meaning Americans. I think that's changed now. I think that now somebody white would just not tend to want to do that. But there are other matters. And I found myself policing, writer saying, oh, he's the one who wrote that horrible thing. Saul Bellow, for example, who wrote that horrible thing in Mr. Summer's Planet. And then, why am I policing Saul Bellow? I love great amounts of his work. Also, he really wrote beautifully about Baldwin and supported him for grants. And like, why am I involved in this? I think it's a new movement to see if there's anything in a writer you should say this puts the writer beyond a pale. I think there's writing by Norman Mailer that does that. There's writing by V.S. Naipaul that does that. And you say, is my job now to start going through the work of these writers, looking for the thing that most offends me, and being so sort of virtue-led and virtue-signaling that I want to let the world know, look, I have noticed something horrible, and I'm not reading him either, like you. I found myself just in Baldwin's sphere, just trying to think, that's actually quite an ugly idea that I would, with a writer like Saul Bellow, for example, who spent like 60 years working on his sentences, that I find a little paragraph that offends me and I go nuts. Well, I don't think that's right. So therefore, I had a good attack on myself. I actually described my feelings as ugly. And instead of, Baldwin always taught me to, I mean, what I learned from his books is often you need to look inwards first if you're attacking someone. And look inwards to see if it's anything you did or you might do or you think. And he's very good on this in certain essays. There's an extraordinary essay where he talks about his own rage. But in any case, he has what I would call a glittering mind, a brilliant prose style, and a sort of vision. And so he's a unique figure from those years. And I don't just mean he's a unique figure from the African American side of things. I mean, if you just think of writers born in those years of 1923, 24, 25, and you think from an outsider side, from my side, from Ireland, from anywhere, from any reader's side, these Baldwin books survive. They are glittering, they're brilliant. And at the age of 18, I picked one up all on my own and read it and just loved it.
Well, the collection is on James Baldwin. Colm Tobin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Beth. Thank you for listening to me.
That was Colm Tobin, author of the book On James Baldwin, which was published by Brandeis University Press. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Books and Whatnot is a podcast for readers, where we talk about the titles we've read lately and those bookish little discoveries along the way.
You know what, Beth? I have just realized what my favorite new genre is. And my favorite new genre is WTF.
It is.
Listen to Books and Whatnot every month from KMUW, part of the NPR Podcast Network.